Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfunding Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/StephenTheWarman, and I am also on Instagram under Stephen the Warman as well. I am joined by two very special guests. Excited to have them do my year in review show of the 2014 year in kickfighting. First, I will start off with Mr. Dave Walsh. Dave, say what's up to the people, tell them what you do at Liver Kick, and of course, give me a little insight on what was your first holiday season as a married man.
Oh, jeez. So, yeah, I run liverkick.com, which is probably a pretty good place for all your stuff about kickboxing. Yeah, 2014 was a year, a lot of stuff happened, and I spent a lot of money, so that was 2014 for me. I spent a lot of money.
Cool. And also, hopefully, not spending as much money, but adequate amount of money, Patrick Wyman is from SheerDog.com. Say what's up to the people, Patrick.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Yeah, I'm the preview writer for the MMA preview writer for SheerDog.com. But, you know, if I could make a living covering kickboxing, I would do that.
Cool. And for those wondering in future, I will probably be doing the podcast for SheerDog. I've been talking to TJ DeSantis about it. So it might either this podcast is going to slide over, or I'm going to do another podcast with them. So that's just kind of a little heads up to the regular followers that I have. So we'll go ahead and jump right into it. Fun year in kickboxing. Clearly, there are things that, you know, if I look at the history of my, you know, my experience in the sport, you know, this wouldn't be one of the higher years for me, but it'd be a solid year. There were some good stuff. I was really impressed by a lot of some, you know, the smaller promotions that continue to put on shows. King of Kings, for example, you know, how Top King emerged. I would have never guessed that 3 years ago that they'd have a fight promotion, but I've enjoyed some of those things. Without getting into the details of the year in general, I'll start with you, Pat. What is your thoughts on the 2014 year in kickboxing?
Well, I think we really saw the heights that kickboxing is capable of reaching when you put enough money behind it and you put enough promotion behind it. Mm-hmm. Because for me, the big story is kind of the rise and then semi fall of Glory. Uh-huh. I think you could see that when you really put a lot of money behind it, when you are really dedicated to putting on a good show, then you can do incredible things. You can put on awesome fights. And I mean, I think as something of an outsider to the sport of kickboxing, you know, it's really hard to keep track of because there are so many events, there's so many different promotions, and when you get everything under one banner, it's a lot easier to follow as a fan. Now, you know, obviously that's not working out tremendously well for Glory for a variety of reasons, but that to me was my big takeaway, just what kickboxing can be if it's all under one roof and if it's all handled well.
For sure, and I agree on all points. In particular, you know, me and Dave talked about it several times on this show. The thing that makes the UFC special is it's your one-stop shopping spot. You know, like you go there and you know you're going to have the best representation of every, you know, fighter in the world, every fight, you know, weight class in the world, and there's a consistent schedule. There's a reason why we know who the matchmakers are for, you know, we know Shelby, we know Silva, because they've got really tough jobs to do. With that said, everything runs through them. You know, everything runs through them. You always know what's coming up. Somebody disappears, they pop up, you know they've got that 3 fights in 1 year contract. It's a lot easier to see the map, whereas kickboxing, we have a history in tournaments, so everything usually goes through. You qualify for the tournament, and then you've got the big tournament for your weight class. Without Glory doing, you know, the shows are without, you know, them having enough shows for kickboxers to make, you know, a living as prize fighters, they look for these other avenues, these Top Kings, these, you know, King of Kings types promotions, and then it just makes everything all confusing. So I can definitely see how there could be a struggle there. But, man, it's such a great product, and when it shines, it shines. We kick it over to you, Dave Walsh. What are your thoughts on the 2014 year in kickfighting?
It started off pretty strong, and then it ended with a lot of weird stuff. It was almost like disappointing in a way. Like I kind of got that feeling that I got back in like 2009, 2010 of like, oh, I think this is gonna die. Mm-hmm. And I got kind of like depressed, because it's like, man, I'm gonna cover the death of kickboxing twice now.
Yep.
And but we seem to be doing okay right now, and we're actually at a point where if someone were to ask me, like, what do I see going forward, I'd almost say I see K1 being healthier at this point, which is insanity on almost every level. But I feel like they made enough mistakes and learned from them, and then the stuff they're doing in China is pretty big right now.
Right.
And kind of worth a lot of money to them. I think they might be in financially a better position. I mean, Glory is at the whim of the millionaire billionaires involved, and if they feel like they're going to keep pumping money into it, and as we saw, I don't think they wanted to keep pumping money into it in the last year. So it's been an interesting year. I mean, the fighters have all done their jobs, and that's I can't complain about any of that stuff, but it's all the little business stuff that's been kind of disarraying.
Yeah, it's crazy that you bring that up, because any year where we don't have a heavyweight Grand Prix to determine who the champion is in the heavyweight division, it's always going to be a weird year for anybody who grew up with kickboxing. Like, if you're paying attention to kickboxing anytime during the 90s, anytime during the 2000s, it's always going to be a little bit weird if you don't see that work out. It's just, it's crazy how the sport works. And, I definitely get that sense, you know, because Glory had four events last year. If I'm remembering this correctly, they had four events. So we definitely want, you know, more consistency than that. Yes. So we'll go ahead and jump into it. I'm going to go ahead and get into some of the awards. I'm going to say my winner. I'm going to let these two gentlemen critique my winner, and then they will go ahead and give their own if it is different. So first of all, I'm going to start with the fight of the year. And this one was weird for me because, again, we didn't have a huge body of work from a lot of guys. And Glory being the biggest promotion in the world, with them only having the four events, Croatia, Denver, Los Angeles, and Oklahoma, not enough opportunities for guys to you know, get that, you know, get enough shine to win this award, to kind of really stand out. And it's crazy because if Bukau had to beat Enrico Kiel, this will blow people away. Bukau fought 9 times last year. You know, like, it just blows me away how much he's fighting not under the Glory banner. It's like, not signing with Glory made him money, you know?
and
that's like the top organization. So, but he, you know, clearly the whole situation with him and how the final ended kind of kills it from, you know, him for being my fighter of the year. I decided to go with Artem Levin, and here's why. Clearly, you know, the Robert Thomas win, that's not the biggest win. That's more of a stay active win. But right. I like the Alex Pieri win, or Pieri win, however it's pronounced. I like that win because that's a young up-and-comer who came off of a tournament win, a guy who earned his way into that spot. Beating Isahak Kaparian is a big win. That's a big-time win. So I like that win. Of course, I like, you know, the tournament final with Joe Schilling. I just like, you know, I look at that run and I go, you know what? Not only did he win the tournament, but the way that he won the tournament had people wondering if he was the best striker in the world, period. Because he's got so many weird angles. He throws really unorthodox punches. His defense looks non-existent at times, and he never gets hit. So it's like, he'll stay right in front of you, arms down, and he'll just make you miss with slips, and he'll look for weird counters. But if you throw kicks and stuff at him, he usually just takes it on the arm or catches it. You almost never see him, you know, go shin to elbow block. You almost never see him really block punches on his guard. He almost always has his hands down, and then he, you know, he'll clench up if you get too close. But I think after he performed, people were like, all right, this was a great card. But there's something different about how this guy moves and how this guy scores. So when I look back on the year, I go, man, do I feel like someone's got a better argument for being fighter of the year than Artem Levin? And that's why I think I decided that, you know what? He's fought more in other years, but I really feel that this was a big one, and that's a big tournament to take. So my fighter of the year is Artem Levin. I will go ahead and start with you, Pat. What are your thoughts on my fighter of the year, and did you have someone different?
No, it's funny. You really mirrored my thinking on this, because I felt like watching Levin's run through the Glory tournament. I felt like I really was watching something different. Like, I was watching a guy who was on a completely different level than the guys he was fighting. And, you know, you can say what you want about his last fight with Joe Schilling before that, and, you know, how that was scored and all of that. But he came out and just took apart Joe Schilling in the final of that, and he made it look so incredibly easy. Like, and it was clear the kinds of improvements that he'd made, and his head movement was insane. He looked like he was inside the heads of the guys that he was fighting, in a way that's you know, I can't even think of a guy who has been that far ahead of the guys that he was fighting all in one night. I mean, he was just on. He looked incredible. His strike selection is ridiculous. He can always find the gap, you know. And the way that he melds together his defense and his offense, and slip. Okay, his hips are loaded. He's coming back from that side. Like that is absolutely next level. Like even beyond next level. I mean, kind of stuff for him. I thought that it was just like watching a guy who was on a totally different level. I mean, the word I would use is apotheosis. You know, like it was like watching a guy over the course of that tournament become the very best in the world.
For sure. And it's cool watching him progress to this point, too. Like, once upon a time, he got beat by Yoelton Clyde Fairtex when Yoelton Clyde was the man. And when I remember him, you know, when he had that fight, I just kind of kept following Artem Levin. And his style went from being a Muay Thai guy to, it's like, you know, in our gym, we do a lot of place sparring. That's kind of where that creativity comes out, where people just start playing with stuff and they realize it scores. And the next thing you know, they start playing with it in fights and it still scores. And the way he was moving, it's almost like every fight was Anderson Silva versus Griffin. Like, it's just that type of, you guys are all fighting second. You know, everybody's playing behind. Dave, what are your thoughts on my fight of the year? And then do you have other offerings, or what are your feelings on Artem Levin and 2014?
I think just because we've gotten so used to judging kickboxing on tournaments that it's almost impossible to pick anybody else, because he won the tournament of the year. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the field was pretty crazy. I mean, you could probably make some arguments for, you know, maybe one or two of the guys, like, yeah, maybe they don't belong there, but whatever. It was the big tournament of the year, and he proved himself once again to be like on this like next level kind of striker. And I think he has never really gotten his due like he should for being as talented as he is. But I think that people didn't buy that pay-per-view, but I guess they replayed it on Spike and people saw it. So it's like, I feel like people might finally get to see that this guy's really good. Like, you know, Anderson Silva good. And that's, I don't think there's anybody else that came anywhere near close. Like you said, you know, Buakaw fought a million times, but the level of competition wasn't there.
Hey, Steve Moxon's okay.
It was okay, but I don't see anybody else having the caliber of wins that Artem had, and with the manner in which he did it, which was pretty impressive.
For sure. So that is Fight of the Year. It is unanimous. All three guys go with Artem Levin. We move on to Fight of the Year. We might have a little dissension here. I decided to go with Andy Ristia over David Kyria. And the reason why I went with it is, in this year, I think one of my favorite things about the elite level fights that we had from Glory this year is they seem to kind of go with the rounds told stories. Now, usually in the history of kickboxing, the thing that makes people really love a fight is exchanges. There's a reason why you will always, you know, you'll just be sitting down one day, you go through your Facebook wall, and if you've got anybody that follows kickboxing or knows a little bit about kickboxing, whatever, you're going to run into somebody who's going to go Zambides versus Shahid. It's always going to pop up. Like, it's just, yeah. it just randomly, I'll be going through it, it'll pop up. Now, I'm to blame a little bit. I put it in my year in kickfight, or my kickfighting documentary. I build on to what's already happening in the world, but it just pops up all the time. And when I see that fight, the reason why that fight was so special is because those guys sit in front of each other and they exchanged the highest level of kickboxing, and the fight went back and forth, back and forth. This year, I felt like the fights, different fighters took over certain rounds. So Andy Ristie won rounds 1, 2, and 3. And it looked like he was running away from the fight, with the fight, scored it down. And then all of a sudden in round 4, David Kyria figured him out, started to turn around, and he scored one round 4. And then round 5, of course, he scored 3 downs, and he got the stoppage victory. And I remember just kind of listening to the flow of the audience, because they had a good crowd there in Croatia, and how everybody was into it at the end. That's the sort of win and fight where it's like, okay, this told me 2 different stories throughout the fight, as opposed to one story of a lot of exchanges. So you look at Mark DeBonte and you look at Joseph Antolini, where Joseph close round, first round, but I thought Joe won round one. Joe wins round two. Then Joe scores the down in round three. And then Devontae pops up like a damn zombie. And then all of a sudden goes right back to work, scores the jumping knee in round four. And then all of a sudden at the end of the fight, Bazooka Joe is just kind of holding on. And Mark Devontae loses because he lost the first three rounds. To me, it's like there are two different stories to that fight. And I thought that that's where a lot of the fights did. They kind of told stories. I like Andy Ristie to beat Kyria because, in my mind, first of all, it was an upset to me because I thought Andy Ristie was going to blow Kyria out. Because Andy Ristie's reign to become, you know, the glory a lightweight champion was, I mean, it could only be described as a reign of terror, as he was just KOing everyone in sight, elite level, who cares. So when this fight happened and everything was going as planned through three rounds, and then all of a sudden Kyria, who's just been getting better, always loses to elite guys, but was just winning the right kind of fights, he gets this upset victory. So that was why I went with this as my fight of the year. I'm going to go in reverse order. Dave Walsh, who was your fight of the year, and what are your thoughts, of course, on my fight of the year?
I've always been a fan of Kyria, and I'm one of the few people in the world who actually likes to watch Semi Schilt in the Semi Schilt style, and he's got the little guy Semi Schilt style, although he doesn't have the reach and whatever, but I thought that was a good, really good fight, and it was really exciting. It might not have been the closest fight, and everybody kind of does like those one-to-one things, but yeah, it was a good fight. I would have to say that for me, though, it's all about the storytelling for me, and the big story for me was Joe Schilling against Simon Marcus, because it was just one of those things of, like, if you follow the American Muay Thai scene, you know Schilling's been around for a long time. Schilling's talked a lot of smack, and people have their opinions on him, and he's fought Simon Marcus a couple of times, and it never ended up good for him. And it was always kind of, well, this guy can talk, but he can't really, you know, pull off that big victory. And then, you know, it was kind of going almost the same way. You were thinking, I think Marcus has this. And then Schilling connects, and it's over, and it's crazy. And it was, for following these guys, it was, for me, like, it was just fun to watch. It was like, wow, finally get that payoff of, like, Joe gets his victory over Simon Marcus. And, you know, he got that victory over Artem Levin, and that was always Levin and Marcus are the guys he can't beat. Mm-hmm. And it was just interesting to see an American kind of get his due like that.
For sure. Definitely good stuff. I'll return to that because when I go KO over the year, that fight definitely comes into play. King, it's you, Pat. What are your thoughts on my fight of Andy Ristie and Devi Kyria? And then what is your thoughts on your choice for fight of the year?
So I think that from kind of an objective back and forth kind of way, because I too would have Schilling Marcus as the KO of the year. We'll come back to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But I think that Ristie Kyria is a great choice for fight of the year. It wasn't my favorite fight. My favorite fight was Rusmal and Kyria.
Yeah.
Just because I think they represent, like, I think that all fighters exist on, and regardless of combat sport, exist on kind of a spectrum with, at one end, you have highly process driven fighters who are trying to win every minute of every round. And if they get finishes, they tend to be a byproduct of their process that, you know, they're throwing so much and landing at such a high volume that they sneak shots through and they'll get a knockout. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have dynamic fighters and, you know, in MMA, who may lose minutes, who may lose entire rounds, but they're dangerous at any given second. And I think Kyria falls very close to that end of the spectrum, like that his offense, his kicking offense, and the kind of weight that he gets behind his big punches speaks to his dynamism, whereas Van Roosmalen is an incredibly process-driven fighter. Like, he is always working a consistent output. He's always trying to win rounds. And, I mean, he has knockout power, obviously. But at the same time, like, he is, like, it's just a constant stream of offense from him. So I enjoyed the contrast between those two fighters, between the big moments from Kyria and the kind of consistent, in the background, Van Roosmalen just landing punch, punch, kick, punch, punch, kick, punch, punch, kick, in rhythm, you know, versus Kyria's much more big shot. He got the knockdown in the third round. Like, so that was my favorite fight of the year. But I think that from an emotional, like, what in the hell am I watching kind of perspective, Ristie Kyria probably has to take the cake.
For sure. And, you know, it's weird because that Kyria-Rusmalen fight, It's the kind of fight where, like, if you're a fan of a sport and you want to introduce somebody to the sport, that's the fight that you want them to see. You want them to see this high-level combination flow of Robin van Roosmalen, and then you want them to see the suddenness of Kyrie, you know, able to turn over his punches and score that down in the third. You know, the only reason why I couldn't rank that one higher is because I felt that it was a 4-1 type of fight. I did have Roosmalen winning 1-2 and then 4-5. And Kyrie, to me, his struggles against those better guys, as you mentioned before, he doesn't have the right kind of enough activity during rounds. And this is Roosmalen's third time beating him. So, like, all those things kind of, you know, weighed in on me a little bit. And I was like, you know what? I like it. And, man, it was entertaining. And if you were to say, Steven, which one would you rather sit down and watch again? I think I'd go Kyrie Roosmalen as well. But I just like the storytelling, the storyline of Andy Ristie, and the fact that the title line, you know, title was on the line for that one gave me a little bit of a lean of that fight over the Joe Schilling fight. I'm going to go ahead and segue into said Joe Schilling versus Simon Marcus fight. My KO of the year is that very fight. And, of course, again, the storylines, there was that moment in that second round where Simon Marcus just kind of bit down and walked Joe Schilling down and just started throwing bombs until he was able to drop him. And then Joe Schilling was able to, you know, score some, you know, points. Because Joe Schilling, for a guy who, if you watch Joe Schilling hit the pads, he kind of comes off like he's a straight up old school Muay Thai guy with a clinch game and body kicks, and he doesn't look like he's going to fight crafty at all. You wouldn't expect him to try spinning stuff, and he does it all the time. Like he pulls that kind of stuff out. And you know, when the fight happened, it was such a weird extension round because the mouthpiece kept falling out of Simon Marcus, and he just got deducted a point, which probably added to him running into the shot. But just the way that Schilling, it's like Schilling didn't even see the punch that he threw. They just kind of threw it to, like, you know, I'm already up. This guy keeps walking me down. I just need to get out of this round. And he just kind of walked him into the biggest shot of the fight. And the KO was like, there's two types of KOs that you kind of really feel. You feel when you've got an away guy going to someone else's home and they score a KO and then the whole room goes silent. And you feel when everyone's really rooting for a guy to win a fight, and then all of a sudden, bang. And then, like, the whole place erupted, and the way that, you know, Schilling walked away. Adding to this KO is the fact that in their first fight, Simon Marcus, you know, KO'd Joe Schilling. They had Marcus did a tie dump. Joe Schilling fell weird. To this day, there's, you know, controversy on both sides. Yeah. People in Canada very much say legal throw. People in California very much say that was an illegal, you know, judo-esque dump. But nevertheless, Joe Schilling got up, and then Simon Marcus, you know, quickly, you know, scored the big left hook and got Joe Schilling out of there. Fight number two, Joe Schilling scores a down in the first round. You think, okay, Schilling's going to get his revenge. Simon Marcus puts you on a clinch clinic and dominates the next four rounds and wins the fight. So once you get here, you're like, hey, chapter three, looks like Marcus is going to do it again, and in a different way. I really think Marcus tried to get used to the glory rules. He bites down in the mouthpiece. He starts throwing. His fights in China helped him a lot because he started KOing guys out in China. Before, he just won with clinches. And China's where he started to let his hands go a little bit. And it just was the buildup, everything into it led to it being an awesome, awesome KO. And just, of course, just the nature of the KO matters too. So Kyrie Ristie is another nominee. Ristie Hollenbach is another one where you just see how crazy Ristie's power is, because that's not necessarily like he loaded up on that hook to get Hollenbach out of there. He just turned his punch over in a very sharp moment and motion, and that was it. Plus, he hurt him with a jab to get it all started. So those fights, definitely cool. There are definitely some cool KOs. Younga's KO over Stoika was definitely cool. But, man, the one I felt the most was Joe Schilling versus Simon Marcus. Can I kick it to you, Pat? What are your thoughts on Schilling-Marcus?
I think that was, I mean, my immediate thought on watching that, and I just rewatched it today to kind of get my head around it, was like, it didn't look like a big shot when you see the way that Schilling throws it. I mean, it's just kind of a short left hook, right? But then, but the way that Marcus ran himself onto it, I mean, just created an enormous collision. And I think the fact that, you know, it was the fourth round of a pretty grueling, brutal back and forth kind of fight, just put him out. I thought it was crazy. But in terms of sheer coolness, Raymond Daniels, like, spinning, jumping, like, crazy kick kind of thing was hard to beat just from sheer rarity. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in an actual big show before. Mm-hmm. I thought that was nuts. Either Kiri Aristi or Marcus Schilling. I like Joe Schilling's KO just because I've always thought he was kind of a hard fighter to get a real read on, you know, because he doesn't look super athletic. He doesn't look super powerful, but then guys run onto his shots and they just fall, you know, like, I watched a lot of his film when he fought on the Bellator card. And his game is just sneaky and weird and hard to get a handle on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it took me about three watches before I could really kind of figure out exactly what was going on and what was going through his head when he was fighting. But I think the Marcus KO, because of the backstory too, yeah, I think that's a fine choice. I mean, Andy Risty doing Andy Risty things is always fantastic. I think Marcus Schilling is a good choice. Obviously Kiri Aristi too, just because of the way that whole thing went down. I mean, that was awesome as well.
For sure. And then, you know, definitely Raymond Daniels. It was definitely a cool one. It's weird when I put together my year in kickfighting highlight. I always do one every year. I'll get that to you later today, Dave. I'm not sure when you want to post it, but I'll definitely have that to you. But, like, one of my favorite things about going through that is, as far as flashy KOs, it was like my third favorite KO as far as like how that goes, because there was a guy who literally landed a, you know, jumping Van Damme-esque kick in a fight. And then there was a guy who landed the Rolling Thunder in a super combat fight. So when I was going through it and I putting the highlights together, I go, wow, as cool as this kick is. And the kick went viral because I was like, man, this is going to be my KO of the year, that kind of deal, whatever. But then the Last Man Standing event came after it. So I was like, you know what? That was a cool KO, but who you beat and backstory matters a lot. And I definitely could see the Raymond Daniels KO being on there because that was a pretty cool KO. Going to go ahead and kick it to Dave. Same thing, you know, Joe Schilling, of course. And speaking of the Bellator shot, it was pretty much the same switch stance, run into the right hook KO that got Melvin Manhoff that night. What are your thoughts on the KO of the year of Joe Schilling and Simon Marcus? And do you have another pick?
No, I don't have another pick. I mean, like I said before, the story behind all of it is just kind of perfect. And it's kind of the thing that, like, that's what makes fights, that's what gets people emotionally invested in them. And then even if you don't know it when it happens, if you, like, hear about it later or somebody talks about it, you know, with you, you kind of go back and look into it, and it's kind of like, wow, this is cool. Like, it has this story to it. And I think that Schilling gets really massively underrated, and a lot of people label him kind of a brawler. And I understand that, but at the same time, he is a smart dude, and when he does something right, he does it deceptively right, and you might not even notice it. And I feel like that knockout over Marcus, many people would have said for a long time that Marcus is just on a higher level than Schilling, and Schilling is just this California guy, and he's got these crazy fans, and that's all he was. And it was just, you know, it was a cool thing. And, it's too bad the Men Who Fight happened in Bellator. I've been saying that for a long time. It's like, why didn't that happen to Glory?
For sure. You know, well, it looks like they work things out, and he's got a multi, you know, contract now, and it's just weird how that goes, but I'll get into that part a little bit later when I do Story of the Year. Let's go ahead and go to Event of the Year. This one was easy for me. It was definitely Glory Last Man Standing. Of course, we've talked about it before, but the reason why this one was so easy, outside of the fact that it was the premier tournament of the year, the production to it was different than anything I experienced. It was very much like experiencing kickboxing. I experience it all the time in boxing. There is your main core of guys that are doing the play-by-play at ringside, and then they have a second team that's away from the action, that's kind of looking down on talking about fights and so on, whatever. But when they brought in The Voice, when they brought in Remy Bonjasky to be part of that team, I was like, okay, you guys are doing something different. When they went in the back, and another thing that kind of adds to the Joe Schilling KO, just when he went and put his arms around Thomas, who was doing the interviews in the back, when he put his arm around him and put his hat over his head or whatever, because he was all smiles as he's moving forward into the tournament, I just remember thinking to myself, wow, this is that added to the KO. But that whole way that they broke that scene down, it was the English version of what I'd watched in K1 for a very long time. Now, K1 always had the away table, and they're speaking Japanese, so I have no idea. But, you know, I'm just into it. You know, I'm just into the scene. They've got their ringside team that's about four or five people, usually some pretty girl and, you know, two other guys or whatever.
The girl that would be screaming and crying.
Yeah, that's, girl, that's exactly. But the same girl who, the fedora girl, you know, they bring her out. She's a living legend there. And then they've got their screaming announcer, you know, and then they've got a person where they'll pop in the back, and that's usually a woman. And it was just like watching, you know, what you experience. And if you were to watch an NFL football game here in the States, you seem like you have someone covering every area. And when they did this broadcast and they just didn't have the people, you know, ringside, and they did entrances mean something in kickboxing. They could probably do a little bit longer job in the entrances, but like the whole scene to Glory Last Man Standing was different. I threw some other nominees out there just to be throwing them out there, but I didn't really have them as that good. I thought Top King Croatia, just because of the setup of it. If for those who got to see the event or whatever, or haven't seen it, the Top King event in Croatia, it took place in like this pit almost, where you had to go down these stairs, and in the bottom of everything's looking down on almost like kind of how like a basketball court set up. It kind of had that feel to it, but it was so high, like it was so high around the ring, and I really liked the presentation of it. I thought that was cool. Plus it had, you know, Murat Grigoryan, Bukau, you know, Steve Moxon. It had a decent card for that event, so I definitely threw that one in there. And then I thought the production for the K1 show in Pattaya surprised me. You know, I thought that was really good too, so I really enjoyed that. So I'll go ahead and go in reverse order again. Dave Walsh, what are your thoughts on my pick of Event of the Year and Glory Last Man Standing?
It's hard to pick anything other than Last Man Standing, just because, you know, it was the premier event. It was the big tournament that we, you know, didn't actually get anywhere else. And then, like you said, it looked like a big deal. If that was, we can debate for a very long time if they're idea on doing pay-per-view was the right one or not, and I think we all would agree on the answer to that. But you know, it was just, it had that feel that this was a big deal, and like you said, they covered all their bases, and it's kind of depressing to me that they chose to blow their wad on a pay-per-view and haven't been doing that for all their other events as well. I mean, if you're gonna blow all this money on events, like something like a loss of like $1 million to $1.5 million a show, why not do it, like, go all the way if you're going to do it? If they're not doing it anymore, and that, I understand it, and I think it's good for their survival, but, man, you know, like, you just watched that event, it was like, damn, like, this is, like, it felt like a big deal, and a lot of shows didn't have that going on for it, and I do agree that the K1 Potty event looked pretty cool, too. That was kind of weird that they went from, like, K1 banner draped over like a soccer goal in like some of those Spain shows to like this like $1 million+ production in Thailand. And of course that event was such a mess though, like general though. The ending to that was just hilariously weird, but yeah, you gotta go with the Glory Last Man Standing show. And it's too bad that 10,000 people bought it worldwide. Like, that's depressing to me.
For sure.
But whatever. I mean, they aired it on Spike a little bit pared down a month after, and 400,000 whatever people saw it. So people saw it. Yeah. It's just not the way it was intended.
That's right. Just on delay. So I'm going to go ahead and kick it to you, Pat. Same thing. You were talking about, you know, what it looks like when people put, you know, money into kickboxing earlier. So I'm curious, what is your view on Glory Last Man Standing? And then, of course, do you share a lot of the same things that, you know, Dave and I share as far as probably shouldn't have been a pay-per-view in the first place, but it still was awesome. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was – I don't think it was necessarily the wrong decision to try a pay-per-view, in the sense that I think at some point you have to gauge interest in what people are willing to pay for your product. And, you know, I don't know how you would do that other than you know, running it out there and giving it a shot at some point. Whether this was the event to do it, whether they should have tried it this early, those are all questions. Those are all good questions to debate. There's no question that it was my event of the year. And this is one of the things that's really striking to me about the difference between kickboxing and MMA is I think in kickboxing, there's a lot more appreciation of the fact that if you put good fighters on a card, whether they're in good matchups or not, it's going to be a better card. And in MMA, you get a lot of crap from fans about, well, don't judge an event till it happens. You can't look at it on paper. And you know, with all due respect to those people, they're just so unbelievably wrong about that. Because better fighters put on better fights. It's not complicated at all. And what you had on the last man standing card was a bunch of the very best fighters on the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. So even leaving aside the production, which was outstanding, I loved what they did in terms of the personalities that they had. The commentating was awesome. I felt like it actually added value. Like I learned new things from listening to the people that they had there. Even leaving all that aside, just the sheer quality of fighters that it had made it a great card. I think it was fantastic. You know, it's unfortunate that financially that kind of effort is probably not sustainable in kickboxing for a variety of reasons. But you know, I feel privileged to have gotten to watch that because that's what kickboxing could be if it really had money and more fan support than it does.
For sure, yeah. And I definitely agree on all points. You know, and kind of adding to that, you know, it's like. And as a person who, you know, makes my living in training, you know, a lot of mixed martial artists and fighters in general, you know, it's sometimes I'll give you an example. There was an event in Australia this year where every single fight in the card was a stoppage. Outside of the fact that everybody won by stoppage, I couldn't tell you one narrative storyline from that card other than the main event. From the main event behind it, clearly you've got fighter A who's, you know, better than, you know, D-level fighter or whatever, or however you guys want to put it together, whatever. Those cards out there are usually made in such a way that they want, if you go over to Australia and there's some Australia fighters in the card, they want them Australian fighters to win. You know what I'm saying? Like the matchups they get are different. And sometimes, you know, of course, and it's just an example of it, you know, in MMA this past weekend with John Jones and so on, you get that and then they charge you more on that day. And then they turn around and the next fight card doesn't look like that and the price is the same. And you're like, well, wait a minute. The product I was buying before was something that was rare. It was these two rare athletes or whatever. Please don't insult my intelligence and tell me that this is the exact same product. And in kickboxing, we've got no chance with trying to do something like that. We can't have a card of a bunch of, you know, A-sides going against, you know, some mook guys. You know, we usually have a tournament format. It's going to be your big, big show. Now, K1 in its history, they did have like those K1 revenge shows and stuff like that or whatever. And they had a lot of cards where, you know, because back in the 90s, you wanted to know who was the best. So, you know, all these world champions in the world, they're bringing them out to to Japan to try their luck. And the same guys kept getting their hands raised all the time. There's always a Peter Arts, a Andy Hoog, a Ernesto Hoost or whatever, you know, Mike Bernardo, like these guys, you just kept losing to these guys. And that's kind of how they separated themselves. So them putting this card together is a reflection of kind of what the sport has been doing on a regular basis. They usually do keep the elite fighting the elite. And those smaller cards can hold their place too. You know, Arthur Kashenko beat somebody that I'm probably never going to hear of again, you know, a couple weeks ago. And I'll take that. You know what I'm saying? Like, not to mention, you know, Nicky Holtzkin. You know, he was injured for a lot of the year. Didn't have a glory card for him to fight on at the end of the year. So he gets a fight in, you know, for a decent amount of money and, you know, some promotion that they had in Turkey. Guy didn't even really want to fight him. And as far as performance goes, the guy didn't look like he wanted to fight him and got another win there. So I look at how the rest of the year played out and how many small shows were giving single fight opportunities for guys. Nothing put it all together like this card. So I'm glad that we were all in agreement on this. Going to go ahead and move to the story of the year. I'm not sure if we're going to get dissension here or whatever, but I think that this is a fun one to talk about. I decided to go with Bacall Leaves the Ring after NK1. The reason why I went with it was because of all the different stories that came from people, and they had to make announcements and statements. And it's weird because it's like, story goes from one side of it, Bacall hears before the fight's taking place that you're going to lose this fight. You know, your contract is towards the end or something to do with betting or something to do with whatever, you know, you're going to lose this fight. So he's going to lose beforehand. He's like, all right, still shows up, still competes. So like didn't put in the protest beforehand. It would have been a great thing to bring it up beforehand because then they would have had to, you know, reevaluate. It's like, well, maybe we can't, you know, he put us on blast. He found out, but then he goes out there And it would have been one thing if Bacow was just dominant in the performance. But Enrico Keel, who Bacow absolutely slaughtered last year in 2013, goes out there and puts on probably the best performance of his kickboxing career. And he scored some good punches. You can make an argument, though I thought Bacow won, you can make a definite argument that we needed an extra round in that fight. The fight merited an extra round happening. But before that decision even comes out, Bacow, who, you know, of course, is going off the information that he had before, he's out. He's left. For the second time that year, he's left. I think he left in China in March, earlier last year, or something like that. And then they got him to come back. I can't remember the exact date.
He was trying to leave.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, come back, come back.
That's
and
right.
It was against Zhu Ziping.
That's right. They Jerome LeBannered him back into... You know, yeah. Jerome, who made this procedure possible. Bacow just probably watching them. Jerome LeBanner's like, you know what? Things don't go right. I'm out. Just like that. You know, so they're going to go ahead and he leaves before. And again, this helps him out a lot. If he had left after the decision, it would have been one thing. He left before the decision was announced. Enrico Keel standing in there waiting for him to come back. They go ahead and disqualify Bacow or call it a forfeit. Enrico Keel celebrated like he'd won, you know, the World Cup. I mean, you couldn't have been, when you watched him, I'm like, dude, you can't be more excited for a guy. Like, you feel like it's all ho-hum. You're like, man, what a disappointing victory to a really weird night anyways. And then all of a sudden, he celebrated as if he had literally, you know, Yoshihiro Sato starched Bacow in the third round and got the victory. But I'm happy for him because it's not his fault. He'd been down to fight another round. That moment and the way that it was on Twitter and the way it was on Facebook and people from the Muay Thai community talked about how clear-cut the decision should have been because Bacow dominated and the way it kept bouncing from the kickboxing world to the, you know, K1's official statement, I was like, this to me feels like the story. Now, of course, they had some other events. I talked about how Glory only had 4 events, and I talked about Glory's, you know, struggle in re-signing people, or I don't know how much effort they put into re-signing people, but, like, you have a situation like Gokhan Saki, who talked about he's waiting on a new contract. Gokhan Saki hears, you know, Badahari goes out and fights 2 guys who, you know, are 39 and 40, wins by KO in the first round and gets, like, $2 million, makes more money than anybody in kickboxing last year to beat 2 guys, both who had beaten by KO before, and he gets all that money. Gokhan Saki goes out to, you know, Dubai and starts training, and he sees how much money's out there, and he's like, well, wait a minute, I want to go ahead and fight some nobody and get a whole bunch of money too. Our Glory, I want you to match this nobody fighting money, you know, and all of a sudden Glory is, you know, Tyrone Spong, who seems interested in signing with them again, he said he hasn't been contacted. People are having that could have been a story. You know, Glory's whole situation could have been a story. But I'm telling you, nothing was on all sides of the kickboxing aisle like the Bacow left the ring situation. I'm going to start with you, Pat. What are your thoughts on my story of the year? And do you have your own story of the year?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the story of the year has to be like I mentioned at the very beginning, kind of the rise and fall of Glory. But I want to come back to the Buakaw thing, because that too in its way is a story that touches on so many different facets of what makes kickboxing an interesting sport and what makes it kind of a weird sport as well, because of all the stuff that happened in the lead up to that, and, you know, Buakaw wondering if he was going to get paid, and, you know, like making allegations about what K1 was up to, like all of that stuff makes that a far deeper story than just Buakaw leaving the ring, you know. And you touched on some of that. And so I think that's a worthy candidate because of the way that it speaks to all of these different competing dynamics within kickboxing as a sport. But for me, like I said, it has to be Glory. Just because I don't think we've ever seen anybody try to do the things that Glory did, and I don't think we've ever seen anybody fall quite as far as Glory did, just because they reached so high with it. And if you look at where they're at right now, it does not look particularly fantastic. I mean, Tyrone Spong's making noises about going back into MMA. You have Robin Van Roosmalen, who won the lightweight title from Korea. Robin Van Roosmalen's at the Black Zillions, and, you know, he's been asked about whether he's going to go into MMA. And so I think the ripple effects of Glory doing the whole thing that it's done, that reaches far beyond the confines of just kickboxing as well. It reaches into MMA. It's both a business story and a straight up sports story in terms of the opportunities that are available to athletes. And like you touched on with the whole issue of pay and Badr Hari, it's a really, really big kind of thing. And so is the Buakaw thing. I don't want to minimize that. But for me, it has to be Glory, just because, you know, where does Glory go from here? That to me is the central question and kind of dominating kickboxing as a whole.
Cool. It's crazy because I actually literally got a message. I train Myron Dennis sometimes, mm-hmm. and Glory just contacted him about fighting Brian Collect on the February 6th card. So stuff's happening, really? Fellas. It's happening as we speak.
Yeah, stuff is happening.
We kick to you, Dave. What are your thoughts on my opinions on Buakaw's situation being, or Buakaw leaving the K-1 ring being the story of the year? And what are your thoughts just on, or do you have a different story of the year in 2014?
The Buakaw thing was so frustrating on so many levels, because it was like people still love him no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he has this history now of going from one like business relationship to another, and then every time he goes to this new one, the other one was so terrible to him and almost ruined his life and almost killed him and all this and this, and they screwed him over and were abusing him and all this stuff. And it's happened like 4 or 5 times now.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was kind of this breaking point of like, I don't believe you anymore. I don't believe you. I don't believe that all of these people have been so bad to you, but then there's always somebody there with loving arms to take you in and to be your like legal counsel and all this other stuff.
Is he your Lance Armstrong?
Yeah, it's just like, it's just so ridiculous to me. And especially like the K-1 stuff, which was like, a lot of it was like misunderstanding and misinformation. Like, oh, there's betting going on. Well, they had a sponsor based in Australia who was a betting site. I don't think there's anything shady going on because it's such a small company of like 3 people or something like that.
Hmm.
Like, they would have to be evil geniuses to be, you know, pulling off some kind of scheme. And then, you know, like, just like, oh, they didn't pay. I were afraid they were going to pay me. Like, they paid them 2 months in advance kind of stuff. Like, there's just all these little things that kind of were in motion with that. The fact that he had a car waiting for him and he was like out like a flash at the end of the fight. It was just like, all of this was just so weird, high drama.
Wait, for real? He had a car waiting for him? Like X-Pac?
Oh, yeah. He literally, like, they didn't wait. It was just, he went over. This is, I talked to Enrico Kill after this, and Enrico Kill said, he came up to me, and he said, good fight, you win, and he ran out. Like, that's what happened. And there was a car waiting at, like, a back door, and he just, like, boom, him and his trainer just, and manager just boom, into the car, out, gone. Didn't wait, didn't talk to anybody, didn't say anything, didn't collect his bags, just gone. It was so just like, I don't know if we'll ever really know what was going on there. All I know is that all of a sudden Top King is the greatest promotion in the world to him, and K-1 was the greatest promotion in the world the year before to him. So it's, that whole story was so frustrating to me. It was frustrating too because people are always apt to believe this whole such and such who's my hero is the victim kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of people when Badr Hari does anything wrong, it's, oh, he didn't do any. This is just people just pick on Badr, and it's like, well, at some point there has to be some truth to some of it. So to me, that was, and honestly, the Buakaw story from a standpoint of a person who runs a site that, you know, lives or dies by these weird stories, that was the one that gained the most traffic all year. That was the one that people cared about the most. So it's hard to pick anything else, although the rise and fall of Glory is the other side of the spectrum of, I've seen my hits fall off because Glory just disappeared, you know? Like, as a person who is running a business off of, you know, this sport, all of a sudden Glory just, not talking to anybody, canceling a fan, and well, I mean, if you really want to be technical, they probably canceled about 2 or 3 events. They just didn't publicly announce them before. But, yeah, the whole Glory thing was depressing. But as long as they come back, it's okay with me. But I don't know. The Buakaw thing is probably definitely my story of the year because that's the one that made me the most money.
For sure, man. It just makes me laugh because, like, you know, that's the, you know, I didn't realize that there was a 1-2-3 Kid Razor Ramon-esque ending, you know, going on where the car is already set up. Like, I had no idea that
Yeah, some people told me, oh, it was representative from Top King, and there's a big conspiracy, and I'm just like, oh, whatever. I heard from, like, 2 or 3 people that there was a car, so I know there was a car. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's driving it, I mean, but maybe we'll find out next week on Monday Night Raw. I don't know.
Like, For sure. And it's like, as you said, you know, you can only cry wolf so many times, because, like, when he first left, I mean, everybody, because of the nature of the relationship that, you know, some of these elite TIE fighters have with these TIE managers, the history of it, everybody believed Bukai when he said he had a problem going on with Mr. Promark. No question in anybody's mind when that came up, and I'll never forget it because I was there and I was in Jamaica for the second, you know, Champions versus Champions card, and Bukai was going to fight John Wayne Parr, and the agreed upon weight is 71 kgs. And Bukai is sitting on the wall chilling, like making no attempt to go over towards. He was fully dressed. He wasn't getting ready to get on the scale at all. Mr. Promoke was just sitting there chilling in the middle of the room. And I was like, I thought it was a weird scene. And then all of a sudden, John Wayne Parr gets on the scale, weighs 71, just as they agreed upon. And then all of a sudden, they called over. And then I remember I was standing closest to Bukai, and I just kind of, you know, gestured for him to go to the scale. He just kind of looked away. And then Mr. Pormuk, who was standing next to him, he goes, "We agreed on 70 kgs. And then he was like, and then they were like, "No, we agreed on 71. And John Wayne Parr walked away. He's like, "This is garbage," that kind of deal, whatever. And then as soon as they walked away, Ernesto Hoos comes to me, goes, "Well, they're Thai, so they're just going to negotiate a price, and then he'll get on the scale here in a little bit." 10 minutes later, they had negotiated a price change around the corner, and he got back on the scale. So when I knew that that was the guy who was, like, running things for him, I was like, oh, yeah, Bukai, no question about it. Fight for your freedom, man. I know Mr. Pormuk is taking advantage of you. But when it was the TIE Fight promotion did it too, and then K1 did it too, and then it's just like, it's starting to become a habit, and it's tough to always pick you, Lance Armstrong. You know, eventually some of these other guys have got to be telling the truth. So, I mean, hopefully he'll keep fighting, and they actually put on some pretty good cards for the top King organization. But, you know, I never want that kind of dissension. I would prefer all the best fighters in the world fight under a banner. If you go fight for other promotion, that's good, because Bukai and his height still fought for – you know, he still fought different promotions, different fighters all over the world. He still kept his name and his brand going while he fought in K1. And I thought that was important. So I'm fine with you doing that. But now he seems to be, like, exclusively with somebody, or else they did them wrong. Yeah. You know, and that's I'm not the biggest fan of that. So we'll go ahead and go into what are we excited about going into this year. I'll start with myself. Then I'll go to Dave and then to Pat. Basically, the first thing that I wanted to go with is, and I can't believe I'm going to say this as well, I was getting ready to give Dave, I was getting ready to send you this write-up on how I felt China had the potential to be the next true home for kickboxing. And I was like, I was thinking about what Japan was, and I was thinking about how many shows take place in China, how many promotions they have out there. And I had been thinking it ever since in March, when I had you on my podcast show and you said that, like, 80 million people or 60 million, between 60 and 80, I can't remember the number you said, watched the event where Bukai fought, that K1 event. And that K1 event had nobody on it. It had no stars. So when I was like, if you can do this without anybody on the card, what can you do when you start to actually get some guys? And my, you know, the podcast show that I did a couple days ago when I kind of announced what my nominees were for this and so on, I talked about how I go, man, China really has, you know, between the fights that Kunlun's putting on and the fights that they're having, the K1's doing there, I said, they could be the home. You know, they've got enough people. You could just, I mean, when you got that many people on that many televisions, you don't even need the majority of, you just get a small niche, and that small niche is enough for you to make plenty of money. And you could have a consistent home there for kickboxing. And clearly it's going to help if you can get a Chinese fighter to emerge and be an elite kickboxer. That's always going to help. And I think that will come because they're drawing from a big enough pool of talent. But, like, you know, there's enough people there to produce somebody eventually. But I really think that moving forward, I'm excited about more events in China. But adding to it, I'm excited about K1's focus on lighter weights. The 60 kg tournament that they got going on later this month literally has – five guys that I would say are top 10 in the world in the weight class. Like, it is the kind of tournament that they need to have. The fact that they did 65 kgs back in November, which had, you know, another kind of sad moment where Yuta Kubo came to the ring with his glory title from the previous year. I mean, I was like, wow, one hand clapping when I saw that. Like, it just shows that he's like, hey, I'd love to be defending this title, but here I am in K1 with this title.
Yeah.
I love that K1 has found a niche. And we had mentioned it before we talked about it. They were doing a good job with a little, but they're starting to make some money. So now they're starting to branch it out a little bit more. So I want to see more K1 in the smaller weight classes. And don't be fooled. Don't be fooled if they fool around, glory goes away, and K1 gets those guys back. It could happen. I don't think it's going to happen this year, but it could happen. So
it could happen. I mean, they have, from what I heard, they have four or five events in Japan that are going to be like tournaments, just straight up tournaments, like this upcoming one this year. And then they're going to have 10 events in China. And those events in China are the one that just happened, drew like 130 million viewers or something crazy like that. Like,
insane.
It, like, and they were like kind of disappointed. They were like, oh, we wanted 300. And it's like, what? Like, I can't even fathom these things. And that's kind of, I mean, they're going full force on China, which is a huge market. And Kunlun did their thing too. They didn't get as high of a rating, but they were only on one provincial network as opposed to like 10, so whatever.
Crazy. So go ahead and mention something that you're looking forward to going into the 2015 season, or mention a couple somethings that you're looking forward to.
I mean, I think China's gonna be big. I think that with the potential money in China, it could be a new Japan for people, and that's really cool. But then the thing is that I don't know where this sits for a lot of these guys who are like already established names, because I don't see somebody being like, oh, well, let's give Merle Grunhart another, you know, whatever he made for that last fight, because Merle Grunhart didn't draw ratings for them. But then K1 held a show the same, like, well, you know, a couple of days previous, and drew 130 million viewers with Zhu Ziping as their big star.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but then again, that's smart because Zhu Ziping is from Hunan, China. They've been from Hunan, China. You know, like, It's these little things of like, well, how did K1 originally get to where it did? And it's like, well, as much as I don't want to admit it, you know, you can be like, oh, well, pro wrestling with Akira Maeda being one of their, like, you know, helping out with production and storylines and kind of stuff. Masaki Satake
yep.
was their big Kyokushin star, and that was he wasn't their greatest fighter. And then you know guys like Andy Hoog and stuff like that, who were, you know, had experience in Kyokushin, were what made them big. So I think that we're seeing an attempt, at least, to building a new market, and I'm kind of excited by that. I think that there's money for people. I think that there's maybe even a future more for the sport. And it's kind of sad that America might not be that. We wanted it to be. Glory wanted it to be. Glory has been putting in the effort. I'm not sure they've found their whole thing yet, but I'm kind of sad that they might have spent all their money without having found their real rhythm and what they should be doing. But I feel that they're doing the right stuff this year. I just think that this year is going to be hopefully more of a positive year than last year, which was a very confusing year.
For sure, for sure. And definitely, I mean, you hit the nail. I mean, most people, they just forget. And it was crazy because of how many people were upset when they look at how Masato and how the seating was done for a lot of the K1 Max events and the fighters that were brought in. And people were like, man, they don't bring in the best guy here and here and here. And they look back at, you know, K1 and the heavyweights, and they go, man, they didn't bring in the best guy here, here, and here. And I'm like, hey, they were a brand that lived to exist, and they existed off of a television audience in Japan. They needed to have somebody from Japan interested in, you know, you got to be interested in the product. Who is, you know, and the way I described it when I did the show on this past Sunday, it'd be the equivalent of being like, okay, I've got this awesome pole vaulter from, you know, Mexico, and I'm playing it in Canada. You know, what does a Canadian have to do? Like, how am I going to get excited about that athlete? I don't care if they're the best in the world. So when Masaki came around, literally he had that fight with the guy's last name was Ward. I can't remember his first name, but like he had that fight, which is just like a super fight that they had in a kickboxing ring that was attached to a Kyokushin event. And they're like, you know what? Let's put the tournament together. This is our guy going into the tournament. Now, of course, once it kicked place, everybody was like, Peter Arts is going to win or Ernest Hoos or whatever. Right. But like that's where it was birthed. It was birthed in this boxing style of I've got a draw. Now let's go ahead and put an event together. So right. I love that China's doing that. I'm going to go ahead and kick it to you, Pat. What are your thoughts? And again, maybe you can build on something that, you know, Dave was mentioning with China. And I don't know if China is going to be able to repeat the kind of, you know, idol worship, if you will, of the athletes that they experienced out in Japan. And I'm not, you know, I'm not belittling the Japanese audience. I'm saying that they provided something special to the athletes that made everybody in the world wanted to go fight in Japan. Like to have people that, to have that boy band kind of feel. To be a kickboxer over there is something that I don't think any country's ever going to replicate. So I'm not saying that. But, Pat, as you look into the 2015 year, what are your thoughts? Or maybe you have thoughts on what Dave said.
Yeah, I mean, I think the China thing is an almost unspeakably huge deal. Just for the simple reason that that is the market that no matter what you're talking about, any 21st century business, China is the market that you're trying to crack simply because when you have 1.6 billion people, you don't even have to be appealing to a majority of them to do ratings that are to do just absolutely insane, unbelievable ratings, you know? Yeah. Like, so I think that's the big thing. Kind of an underrated anecdotal aspect to that is that when I was in Thailand over the summer, I was absolutely blown away by how many Chinese tourists there were there. Mm-hmm. And when I went to see the fights at Rajadharma, I was blown away by how many Chinese tourists were in the crowd there. And I think that's kind of an underrated aspect of this whole thing, that with Thailand right there, it's one of the most popular tourist destinations for the emerging Chinese middle class. And one of the things that Chinese tourists really like to do in Thailand is go see Muay Thai fights. You know, I think that right there you have a massive path to developing new fans of kickboxing as a sport. And, you know, when I was on this card, there were two Chinese kids who were fighting on this card. Not like Thai Chinese, but like Chinese Chinese. Like they had moved to Thailand and they had been training there. I can't remember the kid's name because and I looked at my program and it's like, oh shit, I don't read Thai. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the kid's name. But like, you know, I think he was fighting at 125 pounds and he was just a monstrous body puncher. Mm-hmm. And the difference between what he was doing and the kind of, you know, more standard Thai approach was noticeable, and that's why I remember him, and that's why I looked him up and figured out that, oh, like, he was actually Chinese. But I mean, I think that connection, that being right there, the fact that it's, you know, a 2-hour flight from Guangzhou to Bangkok, the tourism, like there are really a lot of opportunities and kind of multi-layered opportunities for kickboxing to make headway in China. And I was not aware prior to you guys talking about this just how high the ratings really were for those K-1 shows. I mean, mind-blowing.
It's absolutely crazy. It's crazy to me that people are like, people try to write them off like, well, they're not that good or whatever. It's like, I mean, I don't think that K-1 is currently the best right now, and I think they've made a ton of really dumb mistakes. But at the same time, like, right now, their commitment to China is, like, an all-in affair. Like, they run these amateur shows that you'll never hear about, and they've been training, like, referees, judges, like, mm-hmm. timekeepers and all this stuff so they can just have, like, a self-sustaining infrastructure. The same thing of, like, opening up gyms there and stuff. I think it's a weird country that's going to pop up of, like, there's been fight events there before. There's been, like, Wu Leifeng and other kind of shows that, like, have been pretty big and just not on other people's radars, but now they might be.
For sure. And they just – the fact that they went K-1 USA 1 month and the next month, literally a month later, they're going to do, you know, China versus Japan, you know, it's like – Let's go ahead and, you know, keep building on this, you know, play with these rivalries, match these, get good matchups and see what can happen. And, you know, I'm excited. I'm excited about, you know, what's coming for kickboxing. And I really like, you know, that China's getting this focus. And I think that Glory would be wise to say, hey, I realize that we're trying to have this focus on the American product. We're trying to, you know, be essentially, you know, the UFC of kickboxing. That is, I do right. believe, their goal. And I yes. believe that's why they do so many cards in USA. And I believe that's why you get, like, you know, cards that, you know, Spike TV kind of stepping in and saying, no, I want this American put on the main TV card as opposed to this really good international fighter who's ranked, you know. And then their ranking system is just, don't get me started, you know. So, but I understand that they're doing that. Within doing that, man, you just got to look at the world and see where your easy money is. In Europe, there's a huge fan base of kids who grew up and just kickboxing was their thing. Not that they don't like MMA, not that they don't like boxing. They still like it all, but kickboxing was their thing. And I can't remember the fighter's name, but when Ryan Scalia was still writing for Liverkick.com, he wrote and he talked about it. He talked to his guy and he asked him a question, and the guy said, MMA will never fully replace kickboxing in Europe, like because it had that much of a hold on just what the average kid did, especially in like a place like Holland where it's just what you do at 13 years old. It's the thing to do, you know. So it's like I look at that and I go, there are already these established pockets all over the world, just as Pat was saying with China. Because when I went to to Thailand last time I was there, the exact same thing happened. There were tourists, an entire gym brought their whole team down to train in Thailand at Pattaya when I was there. And one of the guys was just absolutely in love with me because I had muscles, and he said that I looked the way a heavyweight should look. And he came to the gym everywhere I trained, and anytime he saw a fat heavyweight, he goes, that guy shouldn't be a heavyweight. You look like you should be in K1. Like it was something cultural for the whole community to go down there. And I go, if they're, you know, if they've got enough money, it's not like the farthest flight or whatever, but if, as you said, that rising middle class, if they're watching your product, you got something. If the middle class is watching it, you got it. So,
and the other kind of aspect to this with China as a whole is if the right government officials get interested in it, all of a sudden you'll start seeing a whole lot of infrastructure and institutional support put behind the sport. Like, mm-hmm. because that's, I mean, I think a good parallel for this is MMA in Russia right now.
Yes.
That suddenly all of these big state-owned sports facilities are getting their own brand new MMA ring, MMA sections built onto them. You know, and they're really putting a lot of money and a lot of effort behind it. And you're starting to see like amateur, like real high quality amateur MMA for teenagers in Russia. And, you know, China, which follows a fairly similar kind of centrally planned model of raising up young athletes, if they get interested in kickboxing and they start including that as a thing at these big sports facilities / schools, then you're going to see a whole new generation of, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of talented young fighters, because they're going to put them through amateur tournaments, and you know they're going to see who's the best. And when you pour those kinds of resources into it, and you start making that an option for kids, like the youth participation rates will just fly off the charts almost overnight if they decide that that's a thing that they're interested in. If they don't, you're still going to get, you know, good participation and good Chinese fighters eventually, but yeah.
They're already doing that, though. Like Kunlun is being partially funded by, I can't remember what province they're doing it in, but it's government funded. And K1 is, because you know their deal right now is with Hunan TV, which is a government part of the Hunan government province. So they're kind of like being funded by that province of China. So it's starting, you know, like to what exactly you're saying, where like this government infrastructure, where they're like, well, let's start training these athletes and seeing where it goes, because they made these little tiny efforts to be like, let's put these shows on and see if anybody watches, and then millions and millions of people watch, and they're like, well, okay, cool, let's give this a shot and see what happens. So I feel like we are starting at that kind of stuff right now, and it's interesting to see, because even Japan didn't have that kind of support. In its heyday, it was still very privatized and not, you know, it was TV networks definitely went all in on them, but it wasn't government for sure.
Okay. Yeah, and doing business in China in general is such a weird thing for foreign companies, that unless you have people who know the market there, like I taught a class on East Asian business history a few years ago. With a professor who's a China specialist. I am not. I just got slotted into this because they desperately needed somebody to teach this class. So oh, I just had to stay a week ahead of the students. I'm a medieval historian. I don't know anything about even modern history in general. Yeah. But like one of the things that I learned from this and from working with this professor who's very, very, very smart and very sharp and like a legit one of the world's best China specialists is just how different it is doing business there, and how the line that we think of between government and private business is really, really does not exist there the same way that we think it does. And it, you know, so to bring it back to K1, like the, and the way that they're trying to get into the China market, I think that if they have people who understand the ways in which that distinction does and does not apply, they're going to make fantastic progress. And it sounds to me very much like those, like the promotions that are trying to do business in China now, unlike the UFC, for example, really, really does understand some of the nuances of that market and how to work their way into it.
For sure. We'll go ahead and, you know, I think all good notes, and I think we are the kind of minds that will be talking about kickboxing for the next 6 days if we don't get this cut off. I definitely think that it's been all good talk. It's been all good push. And of course, I'm always excited when young people come into play because, you know, of course, for those who were in kickboxing over the 90s, the big controversy as far as the amateur system goes came with Koshin. And Japan and how it was run and how it was done. But like as you said, Dave, these are kind of done in secret, you know, like they're not, you know, Koshin was like, because they were trying to force feed, you know, certain fighters, fighter in particular, but because they were trying to force feed him on the American public, people never gravitated or like they didn't like it. They felt like it was being pushed. They're like, what's this, you know, amateur fight essentially doing on this pro card? Because in K1, to their credit, they were trying to figure out their survival. They were trying to figure out, Masato's getting old by that being 30, 31. And he was going to try to walk away from the game or preparing to walk away from the sport. And they needed to figure out what they were going to do for ratings afterwards. So they were just trying to find the next young star. So no problem with that. But in the end, after that attempt and everybody, you know, was against the program and so on, it produced some really good fighters. You know, Koya Robe, he was from there. He, of course, and then Masaki Nori, of course, my son. I love Masaki Nori. All those guys are birthed from that program. They've got several fighters that are consistent, high-level fighters in the who are fighting on an international level in kickboxing right now, who are birthed from that, but they force-fed it. This seems like K1's doing it again, but doing it a little bit wiser by kind of, you know, doing it off air. So that's always good. And I've seen just the other day someone post something on Australia saying that they had a K1-esque tryout. You know, like they're kind of trying to figure this stuff out real slowly. So we're going to go ahead and let everybody have their closing thoughts in the year in 2014, and then we will get out of there. I'll start with you first, Pat. Closing thoughts on 2014.
It was an interesting year, and I think we got to see some real highs and some real low points for kickboxing. I mean, but I think the most salient point for me to take away from the year was just how much talent there is in kickboxing as a whole. I think that this was the first year where I really realized how many amazing fighters there are at multiple weights and the kind of depth that pretty much every division has and the kind of cards that you can put on. When you have the money and the wherewithal and the will to do it, that was my big takeaway from the year.
Well, sure. And then to you, Dave, same thing.
Yeah, I mean, 2014 was a year that looked like it was going to be incredible. It kind of fell flat and near the end, but I think it's done enough to set up this year to where things are starting to look up again. And that's, I feel like it's going to be looked back as a transition year. And I'm not sure exactly what it's transitioning to, but I feel that any year where something you know major happens, even if it's in the background, is still an important one. We didn't really see the rise of any new young fighters or anything like that. We saw some guys look pretty good, and some guys show promise that they'll do good in the future, and we didn't really see any big stars just completely lose it and go away. I mean, you know, we saw a couple of retirements, but they were all ones that we saw coming for years. So it was, you know, it was a year that won't be remembered in the history books for the greatest fights or the greatest movement in the sport. But I think it's done enough to set up the future that it will be. It wasn't a terrible year.
For sure. So, you know, definitely all good things there. And, you know, I'll go ahead and wrap up the final little notes that I had. You know, clearly, you know, my big thing as far as glory goes this year, Sonny Dalback was a young star that they seemed like they had created, and then he didn't fight once this past year for the promotion. Georgia Petrosian, of course, he had hand injury stuff, whatever, but he's still one of the best fighters in the world. He didn't fight once. Nikki Holskin, he didn't fight once. Injury problems there. Gita and Verhierven, fought one time against each other, and Gokhan Saki and Tyrone Spong fought twice just because they were in a tournament. You know, one of the other options that I was going to talk about as far as moment of the year would have been Tyrone Spong's injury with Gokhan Saki, and then how Gokhan Saki, you know, put his arms around him. It's like one of those moments that makes me love the sport despite the bad thing that happened in it. So that's one of those kind of, you know, honorable mention things that I want to mention that happened in the year in kickboxing, because of the Anderson Silva thing, you know, a few months before it, because of the nature of it. I remember I brought it up at our gym, and they were like, man, it seems like it's happening all the time, and people are trying to say that they were pretending, you know, they didn't want to kick anymore because of those kind of injuries. It's different when, you know, what happens to somebody that you're never going to hear of, like some small promotion or somebody who's just some YouTube video, you know, because it happened again on Tatnow, for example. Nobody cared. Right. But when it happens on an elite level to a guy who you're like, it's never going to happen to this guy, it can happen. And people don't know this, but it happened to Gokhan Saki when he went against Nicholas Pettis a couple of years ago. I won't say a couple of years ago, about like 6 years ago, whatever. It happens. And so that was definitely a moment that I'll call honorable mention. As far as young stars go, definitely be on the lookout for Ilias Bilaud and Muhammad Uriah, the young guys that they have. And then Tom DeSmet. If there's one thing that I really appreciated the Infusion brand for, it did a great job of putting on high-level women's fights and giving them the opportunity to have good platforms and put on good fights. But then that number two thing is they have found their niche for giving opportunities to young fighters, and it's almost like they're kind of that showbox grooming type of show. Like, you go there, groom yourself, and then Ilias Bilaud, he ended up fighting on a K-1 reserve fight at the end of the year, and now he's going to be fighting Masaki Nori in the first weekend in February. That's how you move a guy. So I would love it if Infusion continued to be in that role, kind of the feeder system, you know, to the bigger organizations. So I definitely wanted to mention that. And then on the side note, rules. I hate the Tatnow scoring rules, where if you score down, you automatically won the fight, despite the fact that, you know, you get smashed throughout the whole fight. If you score a down, it's the most significant thing. And then you could, like, I watched a fight where a guy scored a down against Alim Nabeev in, like, the first 10 seconds of the fight. Alim Nabeev gets up and beats this guy for the rest of the fight, but he loses because of the Tatnow rules. If it's a, you know, if there's no down, it's a draw, it goes to an extra round, and then they score that extra round. That's a stupid rule. Just go off of who won fights. You're like, who won the rounds? Go off of a boxing scoring. There's no reason to try to be original there. You guys have got a good product. You've got money behind you because Tatnow's an oil thing. You're not going away. So just go ahead and be a regular brand. And then the glory catch rule drives me crazy because it's like punishing someone for defense. If you throw a kick and it's not strong enough to move me and I catch it and you fall down, why am I being punished for that? You know what I'm saying? And so every time they, like, have a kick, you know, catch rule and a guy calls, or they sweep a guy and the ref comes in and says that's illegal, I think Glory should get rid of that. I think K1's one catch rule back in the day when they actually enforced it correctly, I think that's the best way to go. So those are just kind of some leaving notes. Gentlemen, let's give them your Twitters and where to find you and what products you're doing. We'll go ahead and start with you, Dave.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I mean, liverkick.com is probably a decent place to go for kickboxing. I mean, probably. It's on Twitter at liverkick.com. And then I do a lot of stuff. I'm actually not doing as much now. I'm slowing down in my old age. but no, I've just finished my second novel, which will probably be out at some point in the next few months. You can follow that kind of stuff. My personal Twitter is at DVEWLSH. Yes, it's my name without the A's. And the same goes for my personal website. It's just DVEWLSH.com.
Cool. And Pat?
You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman. You can find my podcast with Bloody Elbow striking analyst Connor Rebush at HeavyHandsPodcast.com. And you can find my MMA writing at SureDog.com. Check the week before any UFC event, and you will find the most detailed preview and technical breakdown you will find on the web at SureDog.
Awesome. So that's the breakdown. And, of course, Dave, as I'm going to be releasing it's up to Dave. Dave, I don't know what your best traffic day is or whatever, but my year in kickfighting highlight that I always do every year, I'm done with that. I'll send that to Dave in a couple hours. I don't know if you're going to post it today or tomorrow, but Dave, you'll post it first, and then I'll just start tweeting it out after you post it, so I'll give it to Liverkick. I'll also send it to you. So if you want to post it at ShareDoc, I'll go ahead and send it to you as well, Pat, and then it'll be out there. Pat, I know you're a busy man, and you've got to get back to all those John Jones cocaine questions, you know, questions slash memes. Man, the meme world went quick to him, didn't they? Like, I can't. Oh, yeah. I'm like, I actually got to credit them for how witty and how fast they've been on this response.
People have been saving this stuff up on John Jones forever. For sure. Forever, people have been saving up this creative hateful energy.
But yeah, I really appreciated it, fellas. I'm glad you're able to make it. This is my most fun show of the past year, because I usually end up doing this solo, because you know I'm just committed to kickboxing, so I usually sit down and do this all the time. So I appreciate you guys having the time to come and join me, and then thanks again to all my fan base out there. Keep following the guys on Twitter, keep following combat sports in general, and support kickboxing, because we've got a lot of big stuff coming up. As I mentioned, the K1 event that's going on later this month, the Glory events, the first weekend in February, the Crush event that's got Masaki Nori versus Elias Bilal. Good stuff's happening. Kickboxing ain't going nowhere. It's doing good things. So thanks again, fan base, and I'll talk to you all later. Peace.